are listening to a free version of The Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder. It's time to look in the mirror, America. Do you like what you see?
Why keep referring to Obama as the magic Negro?
Do you like what you see now?
Well, suck on this.
It's just a mirror, America.
Shared sacrifice by everybody.
What could it do to you except reflect your image?
I did nothing wrong at the Minneapolis airport.
The Majority Report.
Far more credible to me than PBS and Frontline.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
If I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Monday, January 12, 2015. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the three-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live. Steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, author of the forthcoming Shale Boom, Shale Bust, Daniel Dicker, on the real reason why oil has dropped so significantly in price. Also on the program today, over a million people march in France over the weekend, joined by world leaders in defiance of the terror attacks last week, notably absent any U.S. administration official, though John Kerry will be headed there over the next couple of days. Meanwhile, strong populist proposal coming out of the Democrats in the House, sadly at a time where they can't do anything about it, but it hopefully will set the tenor for the next couple of years. Speaking of the House, Republicans in the House are going to be voting this week on an incredibly, a far more extreme version of an immigration defunding than had been anticipated, could be leading to the first showdown, which could theoretically shut down at least part of the government. That would be the Department of Homeland Security. Speaking of Homeland Security, General Petraeus, I don't know if you remember him, David Petraeus, who was also the former head of the CIA, had to leave because apparently involved in a, I don't know if it was a love triangle or just a love quadrangle. There was some problem that he had with his mistress. Turns out also the other problem he had is that he gave her a lot of top secret information. But if you're head of the CIA and you have given away classified information, do you end up like someone who has blown the whistle on an illegal program, perhaps in exile permanently overseas, or do you end up in jail like John Kiraku, former CIA agent, or do you just get a tremendous amount of sympathy from the head of the Senate Intelligence Committee because you have suffered already so much that you are crying in your money?
Also money.
What's that?
He also gets money.
Well,
also
he also
lots of money.
He has a lot of money, but you can't draw a direct line between,
no,
to be fair.
This is true.
So I want to keep people in suspense as to what happens. Whether or not you go to jail like the whistleblowers, or you get harassed so badly that you end up working as a clerk at an Apple store. Or do you just basically get a pass so that you can get back to the business of coming on and commentating on television?
I do like the story, though. It was almost like, look, if you would just leave me alone about the other woman that I'm cheating on my wife with, I'll show some intel to you, okay?
Indeed.
I'll share some information. Just get off of my case.
And speaking of this administration, which has been the most draconian in terms of going after whistleblowers and journalists, James Risen will not be forced to testify. All that and more. Oh, we've got an update on George Zimmerman. You're not going to believe it. He still turns out to be a bit of a D-bag. Now, I don't know. We'll get to that. But I do want to we got some very fun sound today, too. I do want to weigh in with this before we head to the interview, because I try not to let what we do here on a daily basis sort of bleed too much into the way that we receive the news. In other words, sometimes you get a little bit meta. You know, I'm not one of those people who loves elections. I will say this, however, that there is a report out that, if true, is going to make the next couple of months, or I should say the next like 17 months, next 2 years, a lot more fun. Former Massachusetts Governor Mitt Romney told a group of donors on Friday that he's considering a White House bid in 2016, a move that could scramble the race for the Republican presidential nomination. Mr. Romney's comments to donors at a meeting in New York City came at a provocative moment, just as other Republicans are taking concrete steps to pursue the nomination. This is for reals, folks. This doesn't necessarily mean that he's going to do it. Mr. Romney, 67 years old, is still considering his options, confidants say. At Friday's meeting, he didn't give a timetable for when he would make a final decision, but pointed to some reasons for another run. You ready for these reasons for him to make another run?
My life is totally empty. There's no meaning and purpose. I can't stand my family anymore, even though I feel I should love them.
That did not come up in the speech. He cited unrest overseas. And concerns about the long-term health of the economy. There's unrest overseas. As opposed to all that
like
time
chef?
Where there's always been like, well, but, you know, all those times throughout history where there's been things overseas have been restful. Unbelievable.
You Boko Haram fellas really need to stop this, you see. that's I don't apologize.
The meeting was organized by longtime Romney fundraiser Spencer Zwick, who attended the session. At one point, an attendee asked whether the former Massachusetts governor was going to run for president. I wonder if that attendee was Spencer Zwick, the guy who sent up the... can I pretend like this is a just a legitimate question, like completely out of nowhere?
Totally spontaneous. They're not planned at all. You just came in here and told me, right? I had no idea. We all gathered in here. We were just... Mitt Romney was walking through the lobby, and all of his fundraisers were also in the lobby.
And you had not been wanting to run again, and then you had a dose of that super male vitality, and you thought, I got to think about 2016.
Question
I got
came
so
up.
Much energy.
You thought about all the unrest overseas.
All right. So, and he said he was seriously considering another campaign. I mean, basically what's going on here is, he's seeing that his donors are coming to him and saying, hey, I just want to get the old check off. We're going to go start donating to Jeb or to Chris Christie because we've got money to burn. Is that okay with you? And Romney went, whoa, wait a second. You're not totally over me, are you? And so it's quite possible... Mitt Romney still thinks one three times a charm.
Godspeed, God's delusion, whatever you need, buddy.
Exactly.
Please do it.
There you go. So if we get lucky, this is going to be – and I will say this. You know, I keep – you know, I want to make – I want to sort of lay down a marker here because I've said this I think a couple of times on this program. I said it on Hayes' program I think a week or two ago. I really think that this could be the year where we finally get one from the crazy caucus, the full-on crazy caucus. Right. Romney had to move way to the right in the 2012 campaign during the primary. And he really never tacked back. He really had to. And I think the guy's, I don't know. I mean, he's not as, he doesn't care about birth control, let's say, the way that Rick Santorum does. But he had to go there. And, of course, John McCain, who also really, at the end of the day, they just care about themselves. Had to choose Sarah Palin. I think we're going to see someone from that end of the spectrum. It's not going to be Sarah Palin is the Hail Mary. Sarah Palin or her ilk, I think, could very well be the nominee. And this is where it's headed. And at one point, we will get to that point.
It's going to be, have you spoken to a David Duke forum? Not... maybe I did, maybe I didn't.
Right.
It's going to become the next litmus
test.
That's
right. That's right. We're going to see someone controversially pick a John McCain as vice president. I really do think this could be the year that it happens. And certainly a Mitt Romney in the race with Jeb Bush and this and that, I think you could see it could enhance the chance of that happening.
I see Jedi Obama at work in a Mitt Romney run again.
All right. Well, let's save that for later in the program.
That.
All right. I recorded this conversation with Dan Dicker last week, late in the week, I should say, Thursday or Friday, if I'm not mistaken. And we will get to that right now. Oh, just a reminder, folks, this program relies on your support. You can support this program by going over to jointhemajorityreport.com, pennies a day. Of course, if you want to do a one-off donation, we have that on the front page of majority.fm. But this show relies on listeners like you for 90-some-odd percent, 98% of our support. So support this program. Of course, justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. When you purchase justcoffee.coop with the coupon code MAJORITY, we get a little kickback, but also, even better, it's basically our coffee money around the office. And if you buy crap from Amazon, again, majorityreportkickback.com, click on the Amazon link there, bookmark it, buy all your Amazon crap from there, we get a kickback. Let's take a quick break. We'll be right back with Dan Dicker. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It's a pleasure to welcome to the program Daniel Dicker. He is the author of the forthcoming Shale boom, shale bust, the myth of U.S. oil independence. He is a former oil trader himself. Dan, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Sam.
So we were both on Hayes the other night. We're recording this on Thursday, and you were talking about the free fall. I mean, I guess free fall is not the right word, but it certainly fell off a cliff. The price of oil, it's now under $50 a barrel as we speak, and there's a piece in the New York Times today of oil rigs being just shutting down, and companies not building anymore. Let's start with just why is oil so cheap now as opposed to a year ago?
Well, you know, I've sort of outlined five things that happened all at once, so a very much a perfect storm driving oil prices down. Most of them are financial. I mean, the one that you could point to that's fundamental would be the overproduction, the undisciplined overproduction of U.S. oil companies here over the last 4 years. But that's been going on for quite a while. The others are all financial. You know, I try to point out in my upcoming book, as well as my previous one, that, you know, most of what prices oil, it isn't really supply and demand. It really is a lot of financial tricks that get played on the marketplace. One of the big ones right now has been a dollar that's just been screaming higher. And as dollars get more expensive, oil gets cheaper. That's just the way that it works, or at least that's the way it works in the trading game.
All right. I want to go through those things. I mean, I just want to touch on this notion of the lack of discipline in production in the U.S. I mean, what is that a function of? Is that basically people coming into finding that there's this they can frack, or they get this shale, and they say, let's just suck as much out as we can and cash out? I mean, what's behind that?
That's, I think, you know, that's really, you know, it's a simplification, but it's exactly right. I mean, the regulatory environment for oil is different in every state. And, you know, as you know, in Texas, there's practically no regulations on the procurement of oil. So you get leases, you're a mom and pop shop, you start very simply with a couple of million dollars. It only costs a couple million dollars to frack a well. And if you can depend on oil being at $100 a barrel and it costs you, you know, $60 to get it out of the ground, then you're good. But, you know, what happens is that the oil drops down, and all of a sudden all those wells that you've been fracking, and by the way, you know, you frack them and what comes out is oil and natural gas. And a lot of these places, the natural gas is so worthless or so difficult to take away, you just burn it at the spot. It's called flaring. So a lot of undisciplined, kind of nasty environmental side effects of this kind of, you know, haphazard kind of drilling that's going on. But when prices go down like they have, you're stuck. You're going to go broke at some point. And that's what a lot of the oil companies are facing right now.
So we have one element of this is the undisciplined, I guess, nature of oil production in this country. What are the other give us those other, I guess, speculative, I guess, or financial aspects. I mean, one, you talk about the rise in the dollar. That's not necessarily something that is specifically a function of the oil industry, but that's something that's impacting it. Is there what was going on with it, with oil trading that's been playing with the price?
Well, one of the things that I point out that's kind of unique is that there's been, you know, an end to the investment bank interest in oil trading. Dodd-Frank and the Volcker Act have had kind of their effect on the investment banks over the course of the last couple of years. It's become a lot more difficult to proprietarily trade all sorts of derivatives. And some of those derivatives have been commodity derivatives. A lot of them were oil derivatives. And slowly but surely, all the banks have gotten out of the business of trading and using physical assets to trade oil. So J.P. Morgan sold its desk. Morgan Stanley sold at the start of the year to the Russians, to Rosneft. That deal doesn't look like it's going through, but it doesn't really matter because the desk is a hulk of what it used to be. Deutsche Bank got out of the business. Barclays is out of the business. I mean, what these guys were doing.
All right, wait, stop there. Hold on for a second. For the sake of people who are just have no sense of what does it mean to have a desk? I mean, what is it when you say they got out of business of proprietary trading? I mean, what does that mean to a layperson?
Well, I mean, to put it as simply as possible, when we talk about people speculating on the price of oil, we talk about those that really have no connection to physical oil. In other words, they don't need it to burn. They're not a user, and they don't produce like an oil company. But they still get involved in the pricing mechanism of oil. And the reason that they do it is because they can make money betting on whether it goes up or down. And this was a big part of investment bank business during the first part of the 21st century. Most of them made several billion dollars a year trading specifically oil. So that was, you know, the function of that is obviously that you want to you keep on trading from without a physical connection to the oil market, and it tends to prop prices. There's been a huge kind of pillow of capital that's kind of run underneath the oil price for the last 15 years, which is now slowly kind of disappearing from the market, or not so slowly. I mean, really started to disappear at the middle of the year, and that's when oil prices started to roll over.
So all these investment banks had essentially one of their businesses was to basically place side bets on the prices of oil, and it was basically Dodd-Frank and the Volcker Rule that in particular that got them out of this business, because they realized they could no longer have these proprietary shops where they're just betting. And we've seen this. We've heard about this in terms of like food prices. Right. I mean, I think there's been a bunch reported in terms of Goldman Sachs doing a lot of this. This is a little bit different than some of these investment banks' involvement in I guess it was aluminum, because they don't even own. I mean, these investment banks weren't getting in the business of keeping tankers off the coast or anything like that, were they?
Right. And aluminum is a good example, because we've not only had a collapse in oil's price, but in all commodity prices this year. I mean, gold is down. Copper is way down. Natural gas is down. Grains are down. I think a lot of this, the deflation, the major deflation in commodity prices, has to do with a lot of these investment banks getting out of not just oil businesses, but aluminum businesses, J.P. Morgan with their copper business. And you can make a connection between the grilling that Goldman Sachs got and their sale of their aluminum warehouses just recently in the last month to a British group.
Oh. So much of the rise, and I mean, at what point, you know, when we go back, I guess, I mean, I can't really remember what gas prices were, for instance, in 2000. But I mean, I feel like they were still within the dollar something range, right? I mean,
right.
How much of where we are now with gas prices, and I guess in some places it's under $2 a gallon, but how was that? When we got up to $4.25, $4.50, you know, particularly in New York, was that a function? I mean, was that all a function of speculation?
Well, I mean, you know, you don't want to place everything on one reason, but one of the thesis that I've been working with for years and have been writing articles and the book has been that there's been an enormous premium that has been built into energy prices over the course of the last 15 years, basically through proprietary wagering speculation. Depends on how you call it, passive investment, ETFs. There's a whole lot of things that play into that. Yes, I mean, in the end, what you do is you create a market that is less concerned with supply and demand fundamentals and more concerned with the financial kind of inputs that are going into it. And as some of those start to come out of the market, you start to see a market that tries to readjust itself more to the fundamentals than it has for the past 15 years, and that's what's going on now.
That's fascinating. And so, will this will this overcompensate? In other words, will it, you know, we've
it
got.
It already has. It already has. I mean, the 25% of all the oil produced in the world today is uneconomic at the prices that oil is selling at today. Well, that means that you can't have businesses where people lose their shirts. They will stop making oil. They'll stop producing it. They'll stop drilling for it. You see those things starting to happen now. But that runs into, obviously, what will be an obvious shortage at some point. But, again, you overshoot to the upside. Markets are you know, incredibly fickle. They go in one direction. They go very hard. They tend to overdo it. And they're definitely overdoing it to the downside now.
And so what we're going to see is that people are going to be pulling back, you know, this story, like I say, there was a story in the Times today that something like we're seeing like 20-30% reduction just in the course of a few weeks on how many rigs come offline, et cetera, et cetera. And so are we going to see that? I mean, are we seeing that around the country and so or around the world, I should say? And then how does it bounce back and when does it bounce back?
Well, you know, in the oil business, there's lots of production that is what we call scalable. So there's some production that has deep sunk costs, very difficult to cut back quickly. And there's others that have, you know, very short time frames to them. The one that has the shortest time frame to it is shale. And that's because it's the cheapest to drill a well, a couple of million dollars. Whereas, you know, if you're doing something in the Gulf of Mexico, it's $4 or $5 billion. And the outlook for a shale well could be, you know, a year and a half to 2 years at most. But when you're drilling in the Gulf of Mexico, you're looking at oil coming out of a well there for perhaps close to 30 years. So, again, you know, scalability is what comes into play when we talk about that. So the ones that are on the closest in the target, in the center of the target right now with oil prices falling, are the shale players in the United States. After that, you're going to see, of course, other long-term projects not be attempted. For example, I saw yesterday that Chevron told the U.S. government they're not going to drill in the Arctic. They've given up their plans right now. That's not forever, but for now, they've decided to shelve their ideas about drilling in the Arctic. They follow Shell out the door in the Arctic. Oil sands projects will clearly be cut back because it's very expensive, oil sands, on the range of oil production. But other things can't be cut back. There's too many sunk costs. There's a brand new project in the Gulf of Mexico that's 2 years in that they're declaring they're going to start to spud first wells in a couple of weeks. And you can't abandon that. You've already sunk a couple of billion dollars into it. You have lease arrangements with drillers and with rig owners and so on. It just can't be cut back. So the Russians clearly don't have as much room to cut back as others. The Saudis don't have as much room to cut back as others. Again, you look around the world and the whole kind of portfolio of oil projects that are out there, and you can see pretty clearly who's going to, you know, who's going to get the bullet in the back first. And it's clearly the U.S. shale players. They're the first on the target list.
But, I mean, the irony is that they, because they can shut down so quickly, they lose their sunk costs, which may be less, but there's like sort of an ongoing, you know, when you talk about these projects in the Gulf where you talk about the Russians or the Saudis, they have like a slow bleed. Is that basically it?
Yeah, it may not be so slow. I mean, the Russians, I saw that they're eating through U.S. dollars at a pretty quick rate. They've got about $400 billion left, and they're going through to about $50 billion a month. So you can do the math. Before they're going to start to default on their own sovereign bonds. It's not that they're not going to bleed and bleed badly. It's that they don't really have a choice. They don't really have a tourniquet. There's no way for them to stop the bleeding. There's too much sunk cost.
And from Saudi Arabia's perspective, they, as you mentioned this on Hayes' program the other night too, and I want to see if I get this right, they seem to be sort of functioning like a big box store would coming into a community. We're going to cut our prices so low that all the local hardware stores and whatnot, they're not going to be able to compete. They're going to go out of business. We can sustain it, and then ultimately we raise our prices.
Well, that's not actually true. I don't think that there's – the Saudis do not make up market prices. They just follow market prices. what they're basically saying is, and I think Chris did very well in getting this, you know, that he sort of said, look, you want to play the oil game, guys? Let's play, you know, and basically they're sitting there and playing Russian roulette, a game of chicken, with other oil producers. And the reason they can do this is, one, they don't have nearly the social responsibilities that the Russians do or we do.
Right.
They clearly have a much lower cost of production. They can get oil out of the ground somewhere between $5 and $15 a barrel. Our costs and the Russians' costs are 10 times that. And they also have a coffer that's filled to the brim with the U.S. dollars that's come from years of selling oil to the United States. So in all ways, they can sit back and withstand low prices a lot longer than anybody else in order to kind of kill the weakies, kill the weak links here, kill the ones that are producing and taking away their market share and the ones that are actually becoming the swing producers and controlling prices for oil. They want to reassert themselves and OPEC as the most important force in the oil game. And the only way to do that is to start killing off some other producers. And in that regard, they're going to win.
So in terms of issues like climate change, I mean, is this going to be ultimately, is this a net benefit, or is this really going to have no impact? Because at the end of the day, it's all going to balance out in terms of consumption.
You know, the way that I look at it is that it sets back, you know, from a renewable standpoint, it sets back renewable frameworks maybe 5 to 10 years, and that's really the horror here. Because low gas prices, if they extend themselves for a year, which I think they can, you know, it's real simple. People go out, and instead of buying a Prius, they buy a Ford F-150. They buy a Jeep. And they've always wanted that Jeep. And gas prices have been a block to that. And they drive more. And, you know, they heat their pool higher. Everything, you know, points to uneconomic reasons to seek out renewable fuels and uneconomic reasons not to burn more carbon. And that, to me, is the crime. I I'm an environmentalist. I'm very much not a climate change denier. And I tell my environmentalist friends, you know what you want? You want Exxon to make $1 billion a year. You want oil to be $200 a barrel.
Right.
That's what you want. Because that makes some renewable technologies not only economic, but competitive. And at these prices for oil, none of them are competitive. They're all non-competitive. And that means, you know, everyone will reach for a fossil fuel first.
Wow. So it's a good time, I guess, from an environmental standpoint and probably just from a general public policy standpoint, raise gas taxes. I mean,
it would be a great time to start a conversation again on a carbon tax, because you could do that without you know, a consumer a blowback,
right?
With prices being this low,
so
and that is the time to do it.
There's a margin for I guess political courage here.
There's no currency and political courage on a carbon tax here. This is a politician's best friend, Democrat or Republican. If you're an incumbent and gas prices are low, you're not going to mess with that.
Right.
You're not even going to think about messing with that.
Right.
Right.
Well, I mean, I guess to a certain extent, I mean, but this is I'm trying to be optimistic on some level that.
Right. Okay. And from an economic standpoint and from a consumerist standpoint, there's no better time to advance, you know, a thought about a carbon tax or a gas tax. Now is the time to do it. It's the best time to do it.
And I guess theoretically it would be the easiest time, short of a massive crisis of some sort, in which case it would be too late, for a politician to propose it, which would be nice and probably wishful thinking on my part.
It is wishful, but it would be a terrific new kind of conversation for some politician to have, which, if he's got, you know, some cojones, would really put him out there in a way that no one else has, to go out there and say, hey, folks, you know, I understand the world of energy to the degree that I know that this is temporary. you know, this is going to self-correct itself, and everybody in the industry knows it, and so do I. And so now is the time to make steps forward that we can be proud of ourselves 5 years from now. So that would, you know, if somebody actually said that publicly, I would follow him. That would be a smart guy. I'd say, that's a smart guy. Let's follow him.
Dan, let me ask you, I mean, when this does self-correct, at what level? I mean, presumably, right, unless the rampant speculation sort of comes back into the market, and presuming it doesn't because it, you know, people have been scared out, when this settles, where does it settle? Does it settle at where it was a year ago? I mean, does it settle in the $4 range per gallon in this country, or does it settle? Does it find a lower equilibrium, or have I just asked a question that if we all knew the answer to, we'd all I'd be very, very wealthy.
Yeah, precisely. It's a $64,000 question, and it depends on a lot of the things you pointed out in the question itself. I mean, will the speculative come back? Well, the investment banks are not there to provide it, but that doesn't mean that someone won't spot the opportunity and jump in. How far will the production cuts go? In other words, what kind of a supply shortage will be created by this? How deep? And that's a function of how long prices stay low before they start to come back. What will the Saudis do once prices start to come back and production comes offline? My guess is that's when they'll really pull out heavy guns and do a real production cut in order to really assert themselves as the swing barrel producer.
Interesting.
And if you put, you know, two of those things together, you come out with, or one of those, you get 75 or 80 bucks, which is about, you know, a reasonable profit margin for a lot of the oil players. But if you put three or four of them together, you get $180, because you could really deliver a very strong speculative reason as well as a really strong supply shortage into a marketplace that now has scared away a lot of the future production that it had depended upon, you know, wherever in the Arctic, in shale plays, with oil sands, in Russia itself, and in, you know, forgetting about Iraq and Iran. So, you know, where will we end up? An excellent question.
All right. Lastly, let me ask you this. What impact did the New York ban on fracking have? I mean, was that sort of by that point, had the industry sort of perceived that as a foregone conclusion, or does that create any? I mean, obviously, the dynamics change because a lot of these fracking wells around the country are shutting down. But would it have, I guess, does it begin to scare people like this is a business that looks like it not necessarily in good shape, because if it's unhealthy in New York, it could very well be unhealthy in my state. I mean, what kind of impact did that have?
Well, I mean, I think it's the most straw, kind of victory for environmentalists. It was. The ban was, populist. It was based on very bad science. It was singular in that it was New York only. In the end, that ban will be removed at some point when gas prices make it worthwhile to remove it. Believe me, the gas players have all they can stand right now in Pennsylvania and West Virginia and further on south, and could care less. Whether New York has opened up the fracking right now, that I think they'd be happy if they shut down a couple more states. I mean, the supply that's out there in fracked natural gas is destroying most of the dedicated natural gas producers here in the United States. So for me, it was hardly a victory worth celebrating. I've always, you know, fracking for natural gas in the portfolio of carbon recovery methods is just about the safest in the world. And you're talking to a liberal guy who knows the oil business. And so every time I see somebody attack, you know, natural gas fracking, I think, geez, you know, put your efforts somewhere where it matters.
Really? I mean, isn't the issue to a large extent, too, just methane leakage?
It's, you know, that is an issue that's not only controllable, but it's easily controllable. And to make a big deal out of methane leakage is you know, just barking up the wrong tree. I haven't found one really good environmental issue with natural gas fracking that hasn't been addressed, understood, can be fixed to any, you know, degree that any environmentalist would find, you know, reasonable. I think the biggest issue, tell you the truth, with natural gas fracking is water reclamation. That to me is the biggest issue, and that's, you know, again, they've made tremendous strides, easily accomplished, not really a big deal. I mean, you want nasty oil recovery, nasty carbon recovery. You're on the right track with oil sands, and certainly offshore.
Right.
I mean, Deepwater Horizon should have proven that, but clearly everyone's got a short memory.
Right, indeed. And from your perspective, TransCanada is at this point hoping that Keystone XL doesn't get permitted, right? Because that basically keeps them from having to go forward with something they don't perceive as profitable.
Yeah, I don't think they would go forward at this point. I think they'd keep a permit if they got it in their pocket and to use for a later date. But the last thing they want to do is build a pipeline, you know, be obligated to build a pipeline for oil sands oil that has no marketplace, and right now it has none.
Fascinating. All right, Dan Dicker, author of the forthcoming Shale Boom, Shale Bust, The Myth of U.S. Oil Independence. Thanks so much for your time today. Really appreciate it.
Thanks, Sam.
All right, folks, we're going to take a quick break, and I imagine we're also folks are going to want to talk a little bit about Dicker's perspective on fracking. From my perspective, I think he discounts the political implications. I get a sense that I know where he's coming from in terms of things like methane leaks. There are technological answers for this, supposedly. You can make the cement columns that line the fracking wells structurally more sound, though they don't seem to do it. And you can quarantine these problems more successfully, though they don't do it. I also just think that he fundamentally discounts the implications of New York State saying not healthy, not safe, and what the broader political implications will be from that. All that said, if the industry is contracting, then they're certainly not spending a ton of money on fighting battles like this, which may have made it far easier for Andrew Cuomo to have issued this ban in the first place. It also, in terms of the tar sands, it also puts the sort of machinations of the Republicans in a fascinating light, and also would in that they're fighting for something that even the industry itself doesn't want. I mean, that is, I think, in many ways analogous to their fights to fight back against the eco-terrorists who are preventing us from having more refining capacity. They don't want to build more refineries. Far too expensive relative to the revenue they can raise. All right, so we will discuss all that and more in the fun half. We've got some great sound. The UK Prime Minister weighed in on a Fox News commentator. Also, Reza Aslan talking to Chuck Todd. We've got to make sure that Michael gets his kickbacks. A heartwarming tale of a pastor who brought Jesus into someone's life, specifically right into their heart. Well, not exactly into their heart, closer to like their sternum, apparently. And Bob Beckel has an oopsie so big that even his compatriots on the Fox 5 rush to his aid. It's sort of sweet the way that they salvaged that. Also, Chris Christie met with federal officials to discuss Bridgegate just weeks ago. This House immigration showdown may turn out to be a little more interesting than we had anticipated. This Democratic proposal on taxing a financial tax and raising the capital gains tax, very interesting, a full-on populist middle-class policy. And, of course, David Petraeus. We've got a lot to talk about. I don't know if we're going to get through
it. Got to get to that sound.
And we're not another 14-hour show today. We're going to be done. I already went long on this one.
Yeah.
All right. See you tomorrow or see you in a moment. 646-257-3920 is the number. If you want to be a part of the program, 646-257-3920. We'll be right back after this.